Good afternoon. It's a quarter past one. The House Judiciary Committee is in session. In attendance are Representative Gruenberg, Representative Lynn, Representative Coghill, myself, Representative Ramirez, Vice Chair Dahlstrom, Representative Samuels, Representative Holmes. We are going to take public testimony, and then we will proceed to the schedule of amendments. We will begin now. The committee is scheduled to end at 3:00. However, we will work through until we have concluded this business and have the opportunity to have a committee vote on House Bill 109. With that, before I ask for public testimony, I would just like to take a moment, and I would like to recognize for the record and the benefit of the committee, the people that have been so helpful. Let me also recognize that Representative Gardner is in the room with us, and that's, we appreciate seeing you, and we appreciate you following these proceedings, Representative Gardner. I would like to take a moment to recognize the work and the time spent by Tammy Kempton, Dave Jones, Joyce Anderson, and Brooke Miles. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been such an honor and a privilege to have you here. I cannot tell you how much you contribute in all the proceedings that I've been party to. Ordinarily, it's, with the exception of Tammy, it's telephonically. It was so valuable for a complex piece of legislation like this that was, at times, and it may yet be this afternoon, emotionally charged, to have you here, to have you available to work with members individually so they can better articulate their concerns. Often, the agencies you work for are difficult. You put those of us that are in compliance or are out of compliance at ill posture sometimes, and I thought that I felt that this week that the committee has shown the best of, and that you have also contributed to an esprit de corps that is commendable, and you have I thought put a fresh face on the Ethics Committee and on APOC. We really have had the opportunity, beginning with Monday, when the governor came and spoke before us. We have really honored, I think, the will of the people in this election cycle. We have been respectful of concerns of members, and we will continue to be respectful of concerns of members and the vocational pursuits that they represent. At the same time, I think that we showed a considerable and appropriate degree of deference to the concerns of the Ethics Office and to the charge of the APOC group. Mr. Jones, your knowledge, you're like a walking encyclopedia for us, and a terrific reference, and we thank you for representing the point of view of the executive through the Department of Law. It was extremely helpful. And so if any other members want to make a remark, I certainly welcome it this time. It's appropriate, I think, to pause for a moment and to recognize and thank these folks for their tireless effort on keeping us straight, keeping the state straight, and honoring that intangible relationship that exists between elected officials and their will and the things that we are charged to touch that come close to our vocational pursuits. The enhanced trust that we need between us and the people with AGEA on the horizon. And so with that, I'd welcome any other remarks recognizing these fine people. Representative Gruenberg. And
thank you. On behalf of my side of the aisle also, I'd like to thank the way you've handled this and the courtesy that you and the other members of your party have shown to us and in the other committee, too.
Representative Lynn.
Yes, I'd like everything you said could be equally said when the same people appeared before our House State Affairs Committee. Just remarkable degree of cooperation and insight. And just everything Chair Ramirez said here would also apply to our State Affairs Committee.
Outstanding. Representative Dahlstrom, thank you very much. we appreciate you very much. Now let's roll up our sleeves. Go to work. We do have online, we have Mr. Shaftel and Mr. Wayne is, I think, on the phone today also. Just before we take them, so that we honor the courtesy that we showed the public throughout the week, is there anybody here in this room or over in any of the LIOs that wishes to speak today? Do we have anybody, Chris? No? Okay. Then with that, then we will proceed. We will close public comment for the week, and we will close public comment on this House Bill 109 at this point. We are going to set aside for the time being Amendment 27 because it may yet be contentious, and I'd like to first take care of Mr. Shaftel and Mr. Wayne, and then I would like to proceed through some of the housekeeping amendments that we have before us, so we can then focus in on three or four of the issues that may have a contentious component, and then we can measure our time accordingly. With that, I think what I will do, Susan, is I'm going to introduce amendment number 28, which is 25-GH1059/0.45 Wayne, and this is the blind trust amendment. This will be number 28, and we will invite Mr. Shaftel and Mr. Wayne to take us through it, and then we will, again, to refresh the committee, we will have three choices: to accept the language that is presently in the bill, to strip out the language that's in the bill and go back to the looser but clearer language that was previously in the bill, or to adopt amendment number 28. With that, Mr. Shaftel, Mr. Wayne, if you're with us, gentlemen, if you could take us through amendment number 28 on blind trust. And for that, would we? Okay, well, yes, sir.
I'm trying to find it.
Okay, we'll get it for you. If you would move it.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move amendment number 28.
I'll object. Mr. Chairman, so we can hear it.
And Dahlstrom moves number 28. Coghill objects, and we are still trying to locate the amendment for Representative Gruenberg. All right, Mr. Shaftel, Mr. Wayne, are you with us?
You have it?
Mr. Chairman, I think perhaps it would be appropriate for Mr. Wayne to, he and I have discussed the amendments, and he has, of course, done the draft here. It probably would be appropriate for him to take you through them. I'd be happy to comment on any of them. I have had an opportunity to discuss all of them with him. I think they're very good contributions to the bill. They bring in all of the points that we discussed yesterday.
Very good. Mr. Wayne, are you there, please?
Yes, I am here. I just finished drafting this a little while ago, so I'm going back and looking at it again.
Mr. Wayne, would it be easier for you if we moved to a couple things and gave you 20 minutes to review this?
It sure would.
Okay, then let's set aside amendment number 28. And it's about 25 after. We will try and come back to you at about a quarter to two. And we thank you, gentlemen, for standing by. So if we can take up... we can take up as amendment number 29, I think we'll take up 0.20. Yes.
Just give us a minute, Mr. Chair.
Let me get it before me myself. It is amendment number 25-GH1059/0.20 by Representative Ramirez, and it begins with page 15 following line 17.
Do you want a motion?
This will be amendment number 29. Yes, let's take a motion.
Mr. Chair, move amendment number 0.20 and number 29.
Amendment number 29 is before us. Representative Gruenberg, you'll object?
I'll object so that we can talk about it.
Representative Coghill objects. So we have amendment number 29 before us. This is the definition of a majority organizational caucus and the conforming language. And this defines what a majority organizational caucus is. Joyce, if you would help us, please.
Mr. Chair and committee members, at one of the committee meetings this week, we added the word organizational before the word caucus in that particular section to define out what the majority caucus and the minority caucus meant. There is already a definition of minority organizational caucus in the ethics statute. It's the exact same language that is also in the uniform rules. And when legal looked at this, they felt that there needed to be also a definition of majority organizational caucus, and that's basically what this does.
Representative Grunberg?
Two questions. One question is, technically, a majority organizational caucus also constitutes at least 25% of the total membership, although they wouldn't, of course, elect a minority leader. Do we need to, and I'm asking, I don't know if Mr. Wayne's on the phone or Mr. Jones is here, do we need to say, to make a technical amendment to the definition of minority organizational caucus to specifically state that that it's either less than 50% or that it's not the majority organizational caucus? Because if you're a Venn diagram fan, one's a subset of the other, really. And I would ask maybe Mr. Jones or Ms. Anderson, should we make a technical conforming amendment to that effect through the chair, if I may, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair. The minority organizational caucus definition is the one that is in the uniform rules. So I'm not sure that you want to change that in the ethics statute, since it is the definition that is already used in the uniform rules.
Through the chair. I was then going to say, do we, whether we needed to make a rule change too. I'm not going to go down that road. Obviously, we didn't have to make that change in the rule because you don't talk about a majority organizational caucus. I think it's probably self-evident, but yeah, you're nodding. Okay.
Okay. With that, is the objection maintained?
No, sir. Which is 29?
Yeah. We have number 29 before us. Without objection, 29 is passed. Looking for the simple ones.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Amendment 40 by me is looks complex, but it's not really.
This is 0.44.
0.40.
0.40. Okay, let's take a spin.
That'll be number 30?
Yes.
Okay, I'll move number 30 unless Representative Dahlstrom.
Right, just one moment, please, to Okay, Susan, we have before us a 25-GH1059/0.40. This is amendment number 30, moved by Gruenberg, Coghill objects for purposes of discussion. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe, is Dan Wayne still on the line?
Dan's busy reviewing.
What this does, we had previously exempted all municipalities from the reporting requirements. This brings back municipalities with populations over 15,000, which is roughly the size of a house district, and puts them on the same schedule as a legislative candidate. So they will have to do their reporting electronically the same time that the rest of us do in the legislature. The second thing this does is it simplifies the commencement date for everybody. Instead of having some people, well, right now, the gubernatorial statewide candidates will have to do electronic reporting immediately if they're doing anything, and so will ballot propositions statewide. But financial disclosures will be starting in, I believe, April of 2009, and then there's a July or a June 2009 for the campaign disclosure reports. So what we've done is for everybody else, we've made a date, and this is back on page 3, line 15, January 1, 2009. So it's really simplified the electronic reporting. For the statewide people and the ballot propositions, it's immediate. And for everyone else, it's January 1st, 2009. And if I may, through the chair,
yes,
Ms. Miles, did I accurately describe what we're doing here?
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Greenberg, I believe so, yes.
And may I continue?
Please.
Ms. Miles, what is the agency, the APOC's position on this amendment?
As usual, the Commission's position would be a neutral one, but I can say that I can understand the concern that the municipalities that are larger than 15,000 filing electronically would most likely be an assistance to the Commission's work.
And how about the dates? Does it make it easier to have this simplified date?
The simplified date would work, too. That's a policy decision best before the legislature, whatever you decide. We thought that the idea of incremental times, so the beginning immediate for ballot proposition groups and governor, lieutenant governor, they can't actually start campaigning yet, so and not until 18 months out from their next election, which would be sometime in May of 2009, right?
Is there other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grimm.
May I ask Mr. David Jones to come forward and ask if the administration has a position on amendment number 30.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, my name is Dave Jones. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. And Representative Grunberg, the administration supports this amendment. It brings us closer to the administration's initial proposal.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Coghill?
Mr. Chairman, if it's the will of the committee to put this in, that's fine. I think probably the time is far out enough, but my original thought was to make the statewide offices a mandatory reporting first and prove out a system. This means a system must be proved out by January. That's a year from this coming January. So I don't know that the system, we've been told that the system could be put in place by July of this year. That could give you 18 months to prove it out, I suppose. You really have probably two election cycles that you might be able to prove it out in. So I just haven't been convinced that we're there yet, because we're not there yet. I mean, we don't have the hardware in place, I mean the software in place, and we have probably what I think Brooke can probably answer this, we're probably what just under 40% of our people reporting at this point, I think.
Mr. Chairman, actually there were 50% of the legislators that are in this body reported electronically. And but statewide and municipal, there was like 17% of candidates. A higher percentage, I believe 68% of political groups filed electronically. And with respect to putting this date out to January 1, 2009, as those of you who file voluntarily electronically will be proving and using the new system as it phases in. And so it should give us some, with the municipal elections held every October and a statewide election scheduled for November of 2008, we should get through any rough spots with our voluntary electronic filers. I'm hopeful.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Grunberg.
Two things. Also, the legislative disclosures, as I recall, would have been required in July 2008. This will move it back about 5-6 months. Is that, through the chair, is that not correct, Ms. Miles?
That is correct. And since that the date of that disclosure is actually March 15th,
sorry,
it will encompass it just as well, moving it here.
And finally, yes. Under the current bill, if there is a problem and there's cause, the APOC can extend the date, so they do have the discretion in there.
Vice Chair Dahlstrom and I were, does this expedite the schedule? We're a little unclear on what this language does. It moves the bar. Where does it move it from where to where?
To the chair. the net effect of this bill really, or this amendment, would be to include in the electronic filing requirement, folks that are running for office in municipalities that exceed 15,000 people. The date changes really have very little effect because, as Ms. Miles mentioned, those legislative disclosures aren't due until March 15th anyway. So moving the effective date of electronic filing from July 1, 2008 to January 1, 2009 is going to affect only those folks that are appointed to a legislative office between July 1, 2008 and January 1, 2009.
Here's the only concern I have is we talk all the time, even yesterday, about attracting high-quality people to serve. Does this dampen that at all? That's the test I have. Does it dampen the people that have to that would have to file electronically in a smaller municipality where?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Cockhill.
I don't believe it will. This actually answers one of the questions that I've kind of harped on, and that is, so many people, including myself, do most of our reporting off the kitchen table. It just so happens that right now I've actually got a Wi-Fi set up in my house, so I can't complain too much now. But that's not true with a lot of people, really in more rural areas. So this puts people that are in town on notice that they better get plugged in by January 09.
Representative Cockhill, is the objection maintained there?
No.
Okay. Give an end to the 21st century. All right. I feel the same way. All right, so with the objection removed, amendment number 30 passes. The next bill I'd like to take up is unnumbered. So I guess it's a conceptual amendment. This is the newsletter amendment. Do the members have this in front of them? I'm going to...
Can you just give us a minute?
Yeah. And so I'm going to label this conceptual amendment number 31. And Susan, I think that's probably appropriate.
What does it look like? Where is it?
What does it look like?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, it's not an amendment. It's because it's a clarification.
The clarification, does it require?
I mean, it needs discussion. That section needs discussion.
So it's not an amendment?
I don't know.
But not an amendment. Do we have to vote on it? We're not an amendment. We don't vote on it then, right?
Does he? Did he get one of these?
He does now.
I do not. But we don't vote. If we're not an amendment, we don't vote on it, do we?
Mr. Chair, there's an inconsistency in what was passed and how state affairs what's already in the statute, and I wanted to point that out to the.
Is it going to have a number, John?
So I may need to do a conforming conceptual amendment after you explain to us what the inconsistency is.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I will be offering conceptual amendment number 31 in a moment, Susan. Okay, Joyce. Does everybody have this document in front of us?
Mr. Chair and committee members, what I'd like to point out is that in House State Affairs, in Section 8, language was passed that would prohibit the use of state funds to send out a legislative newsletter within the 30 days preceding a state election. At the time, I didn't realize, as we all know, it was pretty busy in House State Affairs. I didn't catch that there was already current language in statute in 2460.030C, which prohibits the use of state funds within 90 days of an election. So basically, these two sections are in conflict with each other. I'd like to talk just a little bit, if I may, Mr. Chair, about the reason that this was suggested by the Ethics Committee.
Okay.
There have been occurrences in the past where legislators have sent out newsletters within the 30 days preceding an election, and the Ethics Office would receive phone calls from constituents wondering why the legislator was allowed to send out a newsletter, which really looked more like a campaign piece because it was in the 30 days before the election. And there actually have been newsletters that have gone out even within 20 days before an election. So the Ethics Committee was suggesting that newsletters not be sent out within the 30 days. And basically, I didn't realize there were going to be some constitutional issues, which you should also have a legal memo that Representative Grunberg's office had requested. The Ethics Committee really was hoping that the POET account funds and the office allowance account funds would also be a prohibited use during that 30 days. And there seems to be some constitutional issues with that because those two funds are really the funds of the legislator and not state funds. And so based on that, we really either need to change one or the other sections. I do have a recommendation, however. As you can see on the second page of the handout, I did put together the time frame for the 2006 campaign season with the 90-day prohibition. And the legislative session ended on May 9th, and the last day to send out a newsletter using your state funds, which could include but are not limited to finance committee funds, other committee funds, leadership funds, and also the use of the LAA print shop, really does not give your office as a legislative office much time between May 9th and May 24th to put a end of session newsletter together. So my recommendation would be, based on this language, would be to delete the language that was amended in Section 8, keep the current language in 2460.030, and I would make a recommendation that the 90 days be changed to 60 days, which would allow you as a legislative office to have more time to print your end of session newsletter and still be able to have it printed by the print shop, which of course prints that for free for you, which is then termed state funds, and you would be prohibited. And so it would just give you more time to put your newsletter together and would I would say solve an issue that I receive a lot of calls about from legislators.
So if I understand correctly, in just a second, Representative Grunberg, then what I will offer is as conceptual amendment number 31, and I'm not doing it yet, Susan. But what I will offer is that on page 7, line 16, that we change 30 to 60, and make it conforming throughout the bill. Is that what your recommendation is?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, what page?
Page 7, line 16.
No, on page 7, line 15 and 16, I would delete the language, the new language that's in there, because we also have language in 2460.030C, and that would be the language that I would change. That language is not currently in your packet.
Mr. Chair? I believe, did we give you the proper language, Joyce?
I have a proposed amendment that Representative Grunberg put together. Yes.
But the committee does not have that, is that correct?
No, but it could give it.
I wasn't sure what.
Length, and I was just got really tired and ran out of steam.
I do have something that Representative Grunberg put together.
Does it meet?
It needs a few changes.
Imagine that.
Okay.
Yes.
I could have Jane copy it, and we could make the changes off of this if that would be easier.
I think that would be terrific.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Grunberg.
Maybe for ease, if we could give Ms. Anderson, do you need a few minutes to work on this?
I don't believe so. I can
no,
real quickly tell
clock.
You what the changes would be.
We're mindful of the clock.
Okay.
So I did want to throw out to the committee, Mr. Chair, that I would make the recommendation for 60 days. It's a policy decision on, you know, as what the committee chooses. It's a recommendation based on calls that I have received that there isn't enough time between May 9th and May 24th or whatever the dates would be to have you put a newsletter together.
Yeah. Representative Coghill, Samuels, and then Grunberg.
I'm glad that we found this particular issue, I agree with Ms. Anderson on the timing of it. So, Mr. Chairman, the amendment that probably will come before us would probably delete the section on page 7 and add new language from 2460.030E with a change of 90 to 60. Is that why I understand where you're going?
That is correct.
All right, thank you.
Representative Samuels?
Thank you. And I just wanted to clarify one thing. I agree with the concept of the 60 and the being able to do something at the end of the session. And is the language going to be able to say that on August 23rd I couldn't send one out because now I'm more than 60 days from the general election? It will, once the primaries go, the wall comes up and you can no longer send it out?
Yes, that language is in here.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, Mr. Representative Grunberg. Does the language include the office accounts and the POET accounts?
No, Representative Grunberg, through the chair, the amendment that you're receiving did include the prohibition for the office allowance account and the POET account. And based on, and again, this is a policy call on the committee's part as to whether they want to include that in there. The intent of the Ethics Committee was to include all three of those funds. As I said, there seems to be a constitutional issue regarding two of them. So I throw that out to the committee whether they would also want to prohibit the use of the POET account and the office allowance funds based on that constitutionality issue.
Susan, let me just find out then. I don't have any amendment. Is there an amendment numbered 31 yet?
No.
It doesn't exist?
Right.
Okay. So we could adopt this as amendment number 31. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Representative Grunberg.
Just a technical question. Do we all have the March 21 letter from Alpheus Bullard? Okay. That's the legal opinion, through the chair, Ms. Anderson. That's the one you're talking about, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Yes, Representative Coghill?
Mr. Chairman, I understand the problem with the POET account and the office account, but I think that is a different issue. There's actually a whole range of discussion issues that we have to have around the POET account. Okay. It is it's not as clear as it could be in statute. Every time I read it, I go away scratching my head, and it becomes troublesome. I think if we drill down into that, we'll find that we have a lot of other work to do besides just the spending of this report.
Representative Coghill, would it be easier, in your opinion, if we, rather than to adopt this potential Amendment 31, would it be easier just to delete the new language on page 7, line 15 and 16, and at the same time make a change to 90 to 60 in AS24.60.030C? Would that be an easier fix to remedy the recommendation by Joyce?
In my view, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what we should be doing. And I think there's some renumbering that may have to happen because you have to add that other section in this particular bill. And so we could do it incrementally if you wish, or we can do it all at once.
Representative Grunberg, then I'm going to show deference to you. You've drafted something. If you would, if
it's your amendment, okay. You can take it. Do anything you want with it.
Then we will set this aside and instead offer a conceptual amendment number 31.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Coghill,
if I may state it,
Coghill will state the conceptual amendment number 31. Susan.
Okay. The easy part is on page 7 of the House Bill 109, on page 15 and 16, we would delete the language, unless the communication is sub I, sent during the 30-day period immediately preceding a state election, which is the new language in the bill. And then It would add a new section under 2460.030 sub C, amending under paren 1 sub A, changing 90 days to 60 days.
Joyce?
Representative Coghill, through the chair, we also need to add the word a general election, because it only deals with the primary, because the 90 days covered the time frame between the primary and the general, the 60 days will not.
And that would go
after
an election?
If you look at 2460.030C1A, okay. It talks about a municipal election, primary election. We need to add a general election.
Mr. Chairman.
Do you want to use this? Would you rather use it? John, did you see the 917?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Susan, hang on a second.
Just, Mr. Chairman, for the clarification of the transcriber, the new language also extends on page 7 to line 17. It has the word or for deletion.
The new language on line 18 as well.
Well, I think
we need to remove the sub double I and reinstate the words.
Do we need to remove the double I, the sub double I?
Yeah, and then I think
on page 7, line 18.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so, Mr. Chairman, I would like to include that in the motion as an amendment to that motion, I suppose.
And I'd move that, Mr. Chair.
And then we need to take an amendment to the amendment that it re-includes the word. Re-include is not correct.
Mr. Chairman, I believe we need to reinstate the word accept that was taken out when we remove everything between the word unless and that sub double I. I believe we need to re-put back in the word accept a communication.
Okay, and this is a conceptual amendment, mm-hmm. So a lot of this will be covered by the drafters. Does that conclude your amendment, Representative Coghill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so we have conceptual amendment number 31 before us. Is there an objection? Seeing none, amendment number 31 passes. Thank you for bringing that to our attention, Joyce. It is 5 minutes to two. We'd like to get Mr. Wayne back on the line. Along with Mr. Schaftel. Gentlemen, are you with us?
Yes, we are. This is Mr. Wayne, and I've actually been conferring with Mr. Schaftel during the... He's volunteered to take a stab at walking the committee through this, and I think that he understands it pretty well, and I would suggest that...
Okay, gentlemen, let me just for housekeeping, we'll take number 28 off the that we set aside, and we'll bring it back before the committee. Amendment number 28-25-GH1059/0.45.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Did
we then table the one that we were, the conceptual amendment we were just working on?
No.
We passed it. Okay.
We passed that amendment. That was amendment number 31 passed.
Okay.
And we have back before us amendment number 28, and I believe that there is already an objection, that it's already been moved and there's already an objection. So we simply have amendment number 28 before us, and we have Mr. Wayne and Mr. Schaftel on the line to take us through the issue of blind trust to determine whether we want to adopt new language, toss out the language that was adopted in State Affairs, or maintain it, or the three choices that are before the committee. Mr. Wayne?
As I think I mentioned, Mr. Schaftel is prepared to walk you through the changes. They were mainly done through discussion with him at his suggestion,
okay.
And reviewed by us and felt like they were okay. So.
Okay, very good. Mr. Schaftel?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Judiciary Committee. Just working through this amendment, starting with the first item, we clarified the term businesses because it was broad. Businesses, of course, could include interests in marketable securities. So we instead defined it as interests in closely held businesses. Those would be inappropriate for the blind trust concept. The next amendment was one to make a specific reference to the statutes which define the prudent investor rule, which Alaska has adopted, and this is a uniform statute and is guidance to trustees in managing investments. The next amendment, these are all just minor clarification amendments, added the term trust company after bank as a corporate fiduciary that could serve as a trustee, because we're starting to see trust companies being incorporated and acting in this trustee role in Alaska. And so, and often the trust companies seem willing to take on what you might say a little bit more aggressive or risky trustee activities where some of the larger financial institutions will not. And as we discussed yesterday, you may find some hesitancy, at least at first, in financial institutions' willingness to serve as trustees if they see any increased risk exposure. And we've tried to alleviate that by another amendment, which is at the end of this, Amendment 30. Next one at the bottom on page one, language has been added which clarifies when communications can be made between the trustee and the trustor, the executive, and the subjects that can be discussed. And these include, we talked about the need for a settlor who's also the beneficiary may well have a need for cash. And so certainly those kinds of communications are appropriate. A beneficiary other than the settlor may want to inquire about when distributions can be made in general, and that kind of communication is appropriate. Under the federal form, several provisions were added where the settlor can give a direction to the trustee that the trustee cannot hold a certain type of asset because of executive order or regulation or statute that would prohibit that asset from being held because of the executive's position. Also, the executive could give a direction to the trustee to sell all of an asset if it's held in the trust, because the trustor has determined that that sale is necessary in order to avoid either a conflict or the appearance of a conflict of interest or some other kind of ethical violation. Again, these were taken from the federal provisions. Also, language was added to clarify that the trustee may provide the settlor, the trustor, with a report of the aggregate value of the trust's assets. That was discussed yesterday. Not disclosing the type of assets held, but just the value of the assets. Now, moving down to the middle of page two, in dealing with termination of the blind trust, yesterday a representative raised the question about why this is needs to be irrevocable, and could it be revocable? I've forgotten which representative raised that question, but it was a good one. And the federal form allows a settlor to revoke the trust if it's approved and advanced by the regulatory commission. So that was added here. There's no reason for this to be locked in for the entire, after all, these blind trusts are voluntary, but if there is going to be revocation, then that should be, the regulatory commission should be notified so that it's aware that these assets no longer have the protection of the blind trust. The bottom of page two are the tax provisions, and they replace the tax provisions in the existing bill. These were taken out of the federal form, and they make it clear that the trustee will prepare and file and be responsible for the tax return for the trust, but the trustee will provide the settlor with the information necessary for the settlor to prepare and file his or her own individual tax return. But that information will not identify the assets held by the trust. Again, this is consistent with the federal approach. On page 3 at the top, a prohibition was added that the settlor cannot pledge, mortgage, or encumber the assets. That's from the federal approach as well. Then in the middle, section 33, this mandates that a quarterly report of the aggregate value will be made, and that's so that the settlor will know at least the value of the assets in his or her blind trust. And then the second part of this is one that needs some work, and Representative Grunberg brought this up yesterday about, well, would it be appropriate for the settlor to give just a general direction? Really, what this is a risk tolerance type of direction in terms of how the assets should be invested. And Dan Wayne and I were both a little bit uncomfortable with the language that was put in about conservative, moderate, or aggressive, although we all have seen that in talking to financial advisors, and we're thinking perhaps there should be some other more general language here, which would state instead that a settlor could indicate a general preference as to risk tolerance in investments, but rather than categorizing it the way it's initially been done here. Section 34 establishes that the written communications that are made between the settlor and the trustee need to be filed with the commission. Now, Section 35 deals with a concept that's used in the federal approach and seems to be a very good one, and that is that the trustee needs to provide a certificate of compliance annually with the commission. And the reason for that is it's almost to underscore for the trustee that the trustee has obligations, recognizes and is aware of those obligations for this blind trust. And this is probably especially appropriate when you think about the turnover of employees in financial institutions.
Madam Chair.
Can we interrupt for a moment for a question from Representative Coghill?
The question is, mine only goes to Section 33.
He's talking about subsections.
And I should, can I chime in for a moment?
Please do.
I think that the draft that Mr. Schaftel has is slightly different as to how it's organized, but
are you on draft 25GH1059/0.45?
He is, but he just his is
right
a little bit of an earlier version than that. But it's substantial. It's almost the same. It's just some of the numbering has changed. So what he's talking about is Section D. Or subsection D in the middle of page 3 on line 15.
Okay.
Do you have that, Representative?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, please proceed. Thank you.
Okay, and I'm sorry if my references here have been confusing.
No, you're doing fine. Thank you.
The bottom, what I'm looking at is subsection F that is dealing with the trustee shall make no accounting until the trust terminates. At that time, the trustee will provide a full accounting to the settlor, the trustor. So certainly at that point, the executive is entitled to know what has happened to his investments over this period of time and question them. That would be the time, and under Alaska law, at that point, until an accounting is given, the fiduciary is going to remain responsible for the fiduciary's conduct and performance in terms of handling these investments. But then we get into the last provision, which was added, and this is small g in my copy, which is talking about the trustee's liabilities. And what we wanted to, and what the way we interpreted the federal language was to make it clear that while the trustee is responsible for proper investment performance, as the trustee would be on with any trust that the trustee was managing, that this act is not creating any kind of a greater burden, because you want financial institutions to be willing to take on the responsibility of being a fiduciary
and
or a blind trust.
For clarification, that was small g on page which one, sir?
Well, I'm sorry. It's the last item of this amendment, and the page I have is.
It's on our page 5.
It's actually page 1 at the bottom, so I'm not sure if that's helpful or not.
Oh, page. Okay. All righty. Thank you. Just want to make sure we're all.
It's on
Representative Gruenberg.
Page
3. Thank you. All righty. Are there any questions, Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Both of you. I have several questions.
Please proceed.
Okay. First, I'm looking on page 1 of the amendment, lines 8 and 9, which deals with page 23, line 27, the term trust company. It seems that the language in all of these model statutes that we're using, whether it be New Jersey or the federal, that the trustee must be an institution. I'm wondering, number one, if it's always the case that these blind trusts are managed by institutions, and if so, are there any other kinds of institutions that you'd want to consider than banks, trust companies, or, quote, I guess other institutional fiduciaries? Covers everything. So I guess my only question is, are they always institutions?
Madam Chair and Representative Gruenberg, my own experience has been that the companies that will act as corporate fiduciaries in Alaska are either banks or they are either trust companies that are totally separate or trust companies that have been set up. I'll give you a couple of examples. Alaska USA Credit Union, which is a financial institution, has set up its own separate trust company. Wells Fargo Bank has its own separate trust company. So, and they do this under Title VI, if I remember correctly. So I think in Alaska, those are the corporate fiduciaries you're going to see. If Merrill Lynch, for example, were to serve as the fiduciary, they have their own trust company. So these big financial institutions that do money management have trust companies.
Madam Chair, if I may
follow up,
you. Might somebody select a trustee outside Alaska? My question is, are you aware of anybody that would be qualified to do this that isn't such an institution anywhere?
Well, it's a good question, and I'm sorry I can't answer it. I think what you're saying is, for example, what if somebody wants Goldman Sachs to manage their money? And it's a very good point.
David?
I suspect they have their own trust company for the same reasons that all of these other institutions have, but I can't answer it with certainty.
Madam Chair, if I may continue. And I assume that all of these are bonded?
Certainly all these trust companies are, and the banks, yes.
Okay, Madam Chair, if I may. Now we only apply this to public officials. I could see blind trusts being of this type being useful for municipal officials, legislators, judges, etc. Any comment on that? I'm not saying that that's within the amendment, but whether that would be a policy we should consider as a legislature.
May I comment on that through the chair?
Please do.
Point out that in 3952, I believe it's 410, and has authority to order a public officer under the Executive Branch Ethics Act to put assets in a blind trust.
Okay. May I continue, Madam Chair?
Please do.
On the next page of the amendment, lines 10 through 14, termination. How about if the institution goes out of business?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, you're looking at the material that talks about the trust shall terminate only upon?
Yeah, maybe we should be talking about transferring trustee in that case, I guess.
I think that would be, that's the way I was going to respond to your question, that the trust really isn't terminating. We're going to have a new trustee. Normally, trustee provisions and provisions for succession of trustees or naming of successor trustees, those types of provisions are in the trust document.
So through the chair, so we don't have to put that in the statute then?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that would be my suggestion, that it be handled rather in the trust agreement, and that's normal. You have provisions that are stating what type of trustee must be in office and must be the successor trustee. We've just been discussing those requirements. I think that's all you need here.
If I may.
Please.
Moving down, Madam Chair, to the language page 2 line in subsection 7. Lines 18 to 27. For estate planning purposes and stuff, many couples hold trusts, family trusts, jointly. I would assume that a blind trust could not be held jointly by somebody. Well, my question is, let's say I want to set up a blind trust. Could I set up and put joint assets in it as long as the other settlor was willing to abide by the terms of the trust?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunberg, it's a very good point. From the standpoint of if these assets were community property or if they were otherwise marital assets, you would need the consent of the executive spouse to place them in the trust. And that would certainly be something that would have to be worked out by the attorney who and the clients when the trust was being formed. It is definitely something that would have to be considered, and consent would have to be obtained if we were dealing with community property, or there would have to be some kind of agreement separating property. I guess what you're suggesting, and it perhaps is a good one, that when you're dealing with marital assets, community property, that with the consent of the spouse, those assets can be placed in the blind trust as well. I haven't seen it in the federal statute, but it certainly wouldn't hurt to have a provision like that here.
Madam Chair.
Follow-up, please.
I would ask you and Mr. Wayne, maybe if you could take a look and come up with some language at some point that could be inserted in here on this. I don't want to delay this, but
right.
I'm just flagging some issues that I think we might look at down the line. If you would do that and get that to me.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Jones, could I ask you to come and comment and give us your opinion on the, or not your opinion, but your thoughts on the administration's position on this bill and any other additional comments?
Thank you, Representative
Dalston. Not on the bill, excuse me, this amendment. Let's not go to the bill.
It's a bill. It's a bill.
Representative Dalston, I have to defer to a great extent to Mr. Schefftel's expertise in the area. It's not an area in which I have any expertise. I would note, however, that the amendment on page 3, lines 8 and 9, refers to each beneficiary of a trust. So it seems to contemplate the possibility that a trust could have more than one beneficiary. And I think that relates to Representative Grunberg's earlier question. With regard to the administration's position on the amendment, the administration believes that blind trusts can be an effective tool for public officials to avoid conflicts of interest. However, I understand that currently there are no public officials taking advantage of the existing blind trust provisions. I believe that it may be a daunting prospect mm-hmm. to any public official to go through this process in order to avoid conflicts of interest, and I think quite logically many would choose simply to divest any potentially conflicting investments rather than go through this process.
Thank you. Hopefully the interpretation of this bill will allow people serving to feel that they have another option and don't have to just go, you know, absolutely one way. Are there any additional questions from Representative Coghill and then Grunberg?
Thank you. So I guess, Mr. Jones, the blind trust rule is already in statute now. Does this give us better direction from your point of view?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, I believe it does. And again, I'm deferring to a great extent to the expertise of Mr. Schefftel in the area. I'm not in a position where I need to worry about either filing a disclosure or putting investments in a trust.
Not yet.
So I can't speak from personal experience.
With that, Madam Chair, two questions.
Yes, please follow through.
On page 3, line 14, the question on conservative, moderate, or aggressive, would it be better from your perspective and maybe those who helped draft it that it just be according to a prudent investor rule?
Mr. Schefftel, could you comment on that? Or
Madam Chair, and was that Representative Coghill?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. It's a good point. When we were discussing this particular subject in the office after yesterday's hearing, Larry Biskowski pointed out that the prudent investor rule is a, you know, provides a number of guidelines for the trustee, which an argument could be made that any limitations added by the settlor really infringe on that statute and the guidelines that are provided by that statute to the trustee. So although we know that typically in the investment world these kinds of risk tolerance preferences are almost always explored with the investor by a financial advisor. Mm-hmm. And that's why, to me, and I think to Representative Grunberg, it made sense to allow for that kind of expression on the part of the person who is contributing his or her assets to the trust. I don't think that just reference to the prudent investor rule would allow for this. That's what I'm really trying to say in a long-winded way. If it is, if the committee concludes that this kind of preference should be allowed, then Mr. Wayne and I were discussing that perhaps it ought to be more in terms of expressing a preference in terms of risk tolerance, because that really seems to be what this subject is aimed at. You know, do you want your assets to be aggressively invested, but understand that if they are aggressively invested, you're taking more of a risk and you may lose more money if things don't go the way you hope? Or do you want them to be very conservatively and carefully invested to minimize your risk, or somewhere in between? Or is it your desire that a certain type of income production be obtained because you need annual income? There are other ways. Modern investment approaches called using a total return trust don't require a focus on income, but rather take a percentage of assets.
Okay, I think that has answered the question. Quick follow.
Just a follow-up. Okay. Does that put it in, does the conservative, moderate, or aggressive put it in tension with sub G, which says you have to exercise good faith, due diligence, ordinary skill, judgment, and a prudent fiduciary responsibility?
Madam Chair and Representative Calculate, I think that the latter standard you were talking about has more to do with the competency of the investment techniques used by the fiduciary than whether or not they're being, I mean, certainly if they were aggressive when they were too aggressive and didn't have the permission to be that aggressive, they might be both violating their responsibility to the settlor if the settlor was allowed to give that direction, and they might also be violating the prudent investor rule.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Grunberg, have your questions been answered?
No, just very brief.
Very, very brief.
Okay. Very briefly, Dave, could the problem be solved on line 13 by just putting a period after investment approach?
Very quickly, Mr. Sheftel, and then a quick response from Representative Holmes.
Perhaps that's a good suggestion. How about putting may adopt a general investment approach?
Yeah.
So that, because you do not want there to be any specificity in the kind of directions given by the settlor in a blind trust.
Madam Chair, if I could be very brief with one or two more, that answers
one. You've got one more.
The question on sub E, where the filing a notarized document, I think maybe the commission could develop a form for that, so it'd be a standardized form.
Okay, thank you, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it is important to leave the conservative, moderate, or aggressive in there. These are banks and financial institutions that are serving as trustees, and they will always default to the absolute most conservative investment strategy possible to avoid being sued, unless they've got something explicitly in writing by the person whose assets they're managing that permits them to take a more moderate or aggressive approach. So if you're turning your portfolio over for the next 8 to 10 years, you're pretty far from retirement, you actually want a more moderate or aggressive approach because you want your portfolio to grow, you need to be able to put that in writing in a very, very general sense, or else the bank will never do it because they will be afraid they will
right.
be sued. So I'd like to see that language stay in.
I tend to agree with you. Is there anyone that on the committee that would object to leaving it the way it is? All right. With that,
there is one amendment that was pointed out to me, Madam Chair.
Representative Clockhill?
On page 3, line 24, maybe Mr. Wayne can help us, but I think the trust or at the end of that line should be trustee shall probably make a full accounting to the trustor.
Grammatical, is that correct, Mr. Sheftel? Line 24, page 3.
What could you tell me how many lines from the bottom? Because unfortunately, I don't have numbered lines on my copy.
I can answer that question. It's
seventh line, last word, trustor, should it be trustee?
Following the termination, the trustee shall promptly make a full accounting.
Which one is this, Nancy?
This is sub F, page 3.
Madam Chair, may I address the committee?
Please do.
Oh, yeah.
That's correct. It should be trustee.
All righty. Thank you. So would you like to offer the conceptual amendment?
Yes, I would like to offer that as an amendment. Change trustor to trustee.
Any objections from any members on the committee? All right. Susan, you have that as conceptual.
Madam Chair, before we leave the blind trust, could I have the APOC people to talk to us just for a moment?
Yes. Please. Welcome again, Brooke.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, if I may ask APOC, this is not a responsibility you've had to do up to this point, but it's a responsibility that now is going to be assigned. Do you anticipate any regulatory issues that you're going to have to come up with? You get to make a few decisions on termination issues. Do you see any authority structures that are missing in this?
Madam Chairman, Representative Coghill, I would not anticipate needing a regulatory process for implementing this. It does replace a blind trust section that is in current law, but is, I think, somewhat flawed. I think this is a substantial improvement.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very briefly, Madam Chair. Two things. Page 5, line 16, within 5 days, is that too fast or would they possibly need more time? We're on page 3, line 16.
Madam Chairman, Representative Grunberg, there are other requirements in law that asks for a very quick disclosure to the commission. This would be policy set by the legislature, but I'm not seeing that being a problem for the commission.
One more question, Madam Chair.
On
sub E, the notarized document, I think it would be helpful for trustees to have a form and have APOC, you know, just have a regular form for that. Would we need to put that in a statute?
Madam Chairman, Representative Grunberg, I believe that the commission already has broad authority to promulgate forms for everything in the chapter, so
that's
we're
right.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for that clarification.
Madam Chair, I move amendment number 28 with conceptual amendments.
All righty.
With conceptual amendments to the amendment, is that correct?
That's correct. Are there any objections from members? All right, seeing none, amendment 28 with conceptual amendments is passed. Thank you. We'll turn the gavel back to Chair Ramirez.
Thank you. Representative Dahlstrom. We will take up as amendment number 32, 25-GH1059/0.39. This is by Ramirez, it's 0.39. This is amendment number 32.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Moved by Dahlstrom.
Jack, Mr. Chairman.
I don't see it.
Jack by Coghill.
Maybe
offered by Representative Ramirez. It starts with page 26, following line 7. We'll wait until all the members have it in front of them. Okay. Mr. Jones, will you join us, please? All right, we have amendment number 32 before us. Do all the members have this? This is a state contractor disclosure. Mr. Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed a couple things in looking this over. This is, as I understand it, designed to require that those who are or wish to be contractors with the state disclose with whom they have affiliations that are worth more than $5,000, and by affiliations I mean corporations, limited liability companies, and so forth. I think just as a housekeeping matter, perhaps the reference to limited liability corporation on line 14 should be limited liability company, which conforms with the reference previously in the amendment. In addition, this amendment would put this provision in the Executive Branch Ethics Act. The Executive Branch Ethics Act, of course, applies just to public officers, that is, public employees and members of executive branch boards and commissions. That means that if this were put in the Executive Branch Ethics Act, the enforcement remedies that would be available would not apply, because those enforcement remedies apply only to public employees, members of boards and commissions, and former public officers. So if what we want to do is require state contractors or prospective contractors to reveal their affiliations, it might fit better if we were to put this in Title 36, Chapter 30, which is the public contracting title and chapter. Because ultimately, I believe the goal is to disqualify folks from getting state contracts unless those folks reveal these affiliations. And I think that we can more effectively accomplish that.
Representative Samuels?
Thank you. I just need to clarify exactly what we're doing here. So a person seeking to enter into a contract shall disclose to the representative of the agency the relationship between the person and an association partnership business if the person making the disclosure serves as a consultant or advisor to his or members of. Give me an example. So company A wants to contract with the state to provide something to them for $10,000. I am Pike's Landing, and I'm going to have a catering event for $10,000. So I'm going to, yeah, they got their three bids and they get the contract. They're going to get paid $10,000. What does Pike's have to disclose the relationship between the person and an association, partnership, business, company, corporation, or LLC if the person makes it serve as a consultant, member to, or has financial interest greater than $5,000? Put yourself, forget the legislative thing. If I'm just a company entering into a contract, what do I have to do? What would Pike's Landing have to do in my example?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, if you're applying for a contract and you serve as a consultant or advisor or have a financial interest of greater than $5,000 in some other business entity, then you have to disclose that as part of your application process.
Any other business entity?
Correct.
So you have a sole proprietor. I'll use the example again. I can use the airline for example. Use my employer. So Panair wants to get a contract to fly people around the state. And then you would have to release every other business that you were or associated with in any way?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, you would have to disclose those other entities with which you serve as a consultant or advisor or in which you have a financial interest that exceeds $5,000.
What are you trying to stop?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, this wasn't an amendment that the administration drafted or proposed. However, my understanding is that the idea was to make it clear when someone applies for a state contract what that person's affiliations are. So to prevent the person from hiding behind the curtain and saying, well, what I'm really doing is getting this on behalf of other interests because I serve as a consultant, advisor, or investor in those other interests.
So you're going to sub out the contract. I don't see what the problem is. Do I have to give all of my financial statements for the entire corporation over because I got a $10,000 contract to cater an event? All of my financial records, everything would have to go in because it's more than $5,000. All of my associations, partnerships, other businesses, everything. I would defer to APOC to see is the where did I guess Mr. Chairman, I guess the question is where did it come from? Is this it's not an administration thing, is this I'm trying to help you out here?
I understand. I'm going to withdraw amendment number 32.
Yeah.
Keep moving on. Okay, I'm now going to take up as amendment number 33, 25-GH1059/0.41.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
That is number 33, is that what we said?
33.
Correct, number 33. Move, do I have an objection for purposes of discussion?
I'll object, Mr. Chairman, because I don't have it in front of me yet.
Susan? Do you have which one? 0.41? This is by Representative Ramirez. It starts with page 14, line 29.
Oh, I got it.
This addresses the cleanup language when a member leaves office, so that it's not everything that they ever did in their tenure of the legislature, but addresses the last year or the last term of their service as they're leaving, as in former President Ben Stevens or Representative Croft or Berkowitz.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Cockhill,
speak to my objection.
Okay.
So the annual and periodic reporting that we do would have been made. So if they had made a report, say, within the 30-day window that they were required to and had reported by the 15th of March, which we required, then it would be back to whatever the most recent last report was.
Correct.
Okay.
That's my understanding. Joyce, is that your understanding?
That's correct.
Okay. Does ethics support this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, through the committee, I have talked to Dan Wayne this morning and also with Burke Miles, if she would like to comment. And on lines 20 to 23 on the amendment, we don't feel that language is necessary. Because basically, this is under the legislative financial disclosure. Okay. Brooke, did you want to talk about that?
So, Mr. Chairman? Mm-hmm. So my guess is it's duplicative. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. So I will amend my amendment number 33 by deleting lines 20 through 23. That without objection, the amendment to the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I have another comment.
Oh, yes, Joyce?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Mr. Chair and committee members, first of all, is Dan Wayne still online?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you. I spoke with Dan Wayne late yesterday and early this morning, and I would like to point out that because we changed the requirement to have disclosures within 30 days, every 30 days, we now no longer have in the statute that it says they must be done on an annual basis. So, for example, would be if you disclose that you were on a board and commission within 30 days of being on a board or commission, you would not need to disclose that again until you left office. Basically, the intent of disclosure is on a yearly basis, and so that it is published in the legislative journal, and that if someone were to ask me, for instance, are you still on that board and commission, I would have to look back 5 years to find out if you were still on that board and commission. So we sort of have an unintended consequence of what we did with the 30 days. I know Mr. Wayne and I were working on some language, and Mr. Wayne, I don't know if you have any language to suggest.
May I address that question through the chair?
Please.
I drafted a document labeled as 046 and it was sent down some time back. I don't know if
we have it here.
I did not receive a copy.
Was sent down, I think the committee may have received it just after the meeting started.
Okay, if you'll hold for just a moment, please, Mr. Wayne.
All right.
Oh, here it is.
All right, and so, Mr. Wayne, is 046 the replacement for 0.41? Because I had a note here that said a new amendment coming over. So is 0.46 the replacement for 0.41?
Chairman, it's not a replacement. although it does address the language that was just deleted from 0.41, that concept was moved into 046 and applied into under a different section in the law where it should have been to begin with.
Right. So in your opinion, then, should we pass the number 33 amendment that's before us and then adopt 0.46 as amendment number 34? Would that be the right construction of the bill?
I think that they complement each other somewhat. Although I think that 41 could stand on its own without 46.
Okay, then we have number 41 before us with lines 20 through 23 deleted. Are there questions specific to amendment number 33's 0.41?
I'm making a motion.
All right, is the objection maintained?
No.
The objection is lifted. Seeing no objection, amendment number 33 is adopted.
As amended.
As amended, correct. Thank you, Representative Lynn. Okay, so I will bring before us, and Mr. Wayne, then it is appropriate to bring 0.46 before us as amendment number 34, then, because they're complementary?
I think so. It's appropriate to bring it up and discuss it.
Okay.
I'd like to move amendment number 34, 25-GH1059-0.46.
Object.
Coghill objects for the purpose of discussion. Okay, Mr. Wayne, can you speak to number 34 for us, please?
I will speak to it on lines 2 and 3 of the amendment. This is it addresses the instance of a legislator or a legislative employee who may have a history that involves that reported or that ought to be made public because of the new 30-day deadline, public wouldn't know about. For example, because the new 30-day deadline only kicks in when a matter commences. So let's say you owned a business that might otherwise be reportable if you were already serving in the legislature. You came into the legislature, that matter commenced 3 years ago, then there's a couple ways you could look at it. You're either out of compliance by not reporting it the first day you get there, or you may never have to report it. So I think this clears that up a little bit. Starting on line 7 of the amendment, it added a subsection C, to 2460105. And what that does is it said that even though subsections A and B of that section talk about a 30-day filing requirement, that the disclosures that are under B of the section also have to be made annually. And that B identifies four types of sort of continuing or ongoing disclosable matters. If you look at the, I think you need to look at the bill, page 14, line 11, that's subsection B, and those four subparagraphs underneath it list the types of things that Ms. Anderson was talking about a moment ago the committee feels should be reported with more regularity than just one time.
Okay. Are there, I see Joyce is nodding her head. Are there questions about amendment number 34 from the members? Is the objection maintained, Representative Coghill?
No, I think the best I understand it, I don't know that I totally understand when an employee first comes subject to this chapter. I still think the 30-day rule applies, but I understand the annual report need. So if we put in the annual report, do we still need this, when you first become subject to this chapter, if you have an annual report due? So just help me with that.
Representative Coghill, through the chair, the reason that that language was put in is that if you look at the language on the bottom of page 13 and page 14 in your bill, it really only says that the disclosure shall be after the commencement of the matter or interest. And so what we're doing is we're catching what Mr. Wayne was saying, that is, if you are already on a board or commission, you do need to disclose that, not just the commencement of being on the board or commission.
I'm sorry. Does that make sense? I missed the commencement part. You're right.
Okay.
I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection, amendment number 34 is adopted. All right, next we're going to take up by Representative Gruenberg 25-GH1059/0.44. This would be amendment number 34. No, I'm sorry, number 35.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Dahlstrom moves.
I'll object, Mr. Chairman, so that I know it.
All right. Have it yet, Susan?
Okay.
0.44. 1 second. Let's have the members just hold for.
Correct.
Amendment number 35.
So it's 0.44.
Representative Gruenberg, can you speak to this amendment in its broadest context possible to make sure that the will of the committee is going to be here to fairly consider it, or whether it steps outside of the charge of House Bill 109? It looks like a lengthy amendment with a lot of new language. Can you take us through this,
please? And by the way, we should have Mr. Alpheus Bullard available if there are questions. If the members would refer back to amendment number 2 that we adopted a number of days ago, which was stated that the spouse or domestic partner of a legislator may not be a lobbyist. This addresses a contingency that it may very well be, and if the members look at, is there a legal opinion that goes with this? I'm sorry. Okay, there should be a legal opinion that explains this in the packet a little as well. It is possible that the amendment number 2 may be held unconstitutional because it is beyond the jurisdiction to regulate a spouse or domestic partner by absolutely prohibiting them to be a lobbyist. Not only of the legislature, but of an executive branch, municipal government, anything. If that occurs, and amendment number 2 is struck down, this is a more narrowly tailored amendment that simply prohibits the members from discussing matters of legislative concern with the lobbyist.
Is that not correct?
Yes. That's it, very basically. It is modeled on the congressional model we discussed, and it's simply, if you can't prohibit the person from lobbying at all because that's unconstitutional, it would say that we cannot discuss matters of legislative concern with the lobbyist.
Oh, you're wanting.
Very good. Yeah. Susan, will you take the roll?
Representative Coghill.
No.
Representative Samuels.
No.
Representative Lynn.
No.
Representative Holmes.
No.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom.
No.
Representative Rammers.
No.
One yes, six no.
All right, amendment number 35 fails to pass. Now let's take up amendment number, let's take off the table amendment number 25. This was 25-GH1059-0.6 by Ramirez. This is the retirement pension benefit forfeiture. And I think, Representative Gruenberg, there is an opinion.
Yes, there is.
That you ordered from Mr. Wayne.
Right.
Regarding this, would you like to take us through the legal opinion? I can just bring it back on the table. Is that correct?
I'd like to move it from the table.
All right, Dahlstrom has removed it from being tabled. Without objection, we have amendment number 25 back before us. Representative Gruenberg, would you take us through the legal opinion?
I just received this. Dan Wayne is on the phone.
Mr. Wayne, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Would you take us through your legal opinion, please, as it relates to the amendment?
Okay. Does everyone have a copy of the opinion, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay.
The 27 on it.
No, it's 0.6.
For all, Mr. Chairman, I
25.
They say in the first paragraph of the memo, it's not really possible ever to predict with certainty how the court's going to come out on something. But in my opinion, after researching this, I think the court would probably resolve most of the constitutional issues raised by this amendment in favor of the state if it becomes law. There are some exceptions. One of them has to do with state employees covered by collective bargaining agreements. I think that would be a constitutional violation to forfeiture on a state employee that's covered by a collective bargaining agreement that's pretty in effect when the language becomes law. In the subsequent round of negotiations, the union and the state would be prohibited from agreeing to something in a contract that's inconsistent with state law. And so at that point, once the new agreement goes into effect, state employees could be constitutionally have their pension rights forfeited. But until then, probably be a violation. I think constitutionally that after looking at law in other states, Illinois is a good one to look at, that issue about taking away somebody's benefits, there's a difference between taking away somebody's benefits that have already accrued and taking away benefits that not yet accrued or that accrued after the offense. And so that's where the line is drawn here, and I think because of that, because it's drawn from the date of the offense, that I think that we'd have a good chance of withstanding a constitutional challenge in court, because I think the court could reach the conclusion that, yes, these are important rights, but when we balance it against the importance of gaining the public's trust in government, which is, some scholars say, is what keeps government in business, keeps them from the government from being replaced by another government, because that's an important interest as well. That.
So, Mr. Wayne, did you say you think that the court would support?
I think the court would find in favor of the state if, at least under the on the issue of taking away someone's benefits after the date of the offense.
Okay, very very good. Let's take it back to the committee and see if there's discussion. Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that I've been kind of persistent at in putting this ethics legislation together is try to keep the criminal issues out of it. And this is going down that road, I think. And so I'm going to object to it just on those grounds. I think it's a worthy discussion, but it's a penalty situation that I think deserves a whole different venue. So I'm going to speak against it.
Okay. I'm going to speak in favor of it in general. Is there other discussion? Otherwise, we'll take a roll. Seeing no other discussion, Susan, would you please take the roll on amendment number 25?
Representative Samuels.
Yes.
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Holmes.
No.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Yes.
Representative Coghill.
No.
Representative Rammers.
Yes.
Five yes, two no.
All right. Let's have some fun.
Chairman, if I could offer mine first.
All right. I have, these are both the same, I have two amendments by Samuels. Page 1, line 1, 4, 5, or page 13?
Page 13. We do not need a title change.
Okay. We're going to find it there.
All right. So this is amendment number 36.
I'll move it.
Are they Representative Samuels?
I'll just object.
Don't you have a meeting out there?
Susan, do you have this one?
We're good from here. Sound like they have too much fun.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, what number is this?
36.
36.
Got taken care of.
Discussion?
What we tried to do, Mr. Chairman, what we tried to do here was find some middle ground here. And it is my belief, and I think Mr. Jones said it earlier during the brief at ease, is you don't want a legislator going before an agency or any other body and throwing their weight around. People know who we all are. People have the perception. The minute you walk in the room, they have the perception, and you get treated differently no matter what you do. So what we have said, if you go down to the fourth line from the bottom where it says inclusion in the journal, from the first part of the amendment through inclusion of the journal, those activities need to be disclosed. So if a legislator or a legislative employee represents another person, including Chairman calling the ABC, wait for him to get back. We're messing with your life here. What we've said is a legislator or a legislative employee who represents another person shall disclose the name of the person. So if you had to go before planning and zoning, you would have to make that disclosure to APOC. To ethics. The second part is on the fourth line from the bottom where it starts a legislator. It says that you may not represent another person for compensation before an entity of the executive branch or the legislature for compensation other than by the state of Alaska, unless you are the person that's being represented. So in the example that I have with my two people to my left here, if the chairman is calling ABC, the person is him. Essentially, he has control over the LLC. He could still call the ABC. If your employee was a legislator, you could not have your employee could not. I, as an employee of Pennair, could no longer do what I disclosed. And granted, I went way over the bounds probably of needing to disclose. I could no longer do what I did 3 years ago and have a conversation regarding any of it. I would preclude myself from doing that. You, if you had a legislator as an employee, they could not do it. And what I tried to do is craft it so that you didn't have the manager of the company look around their management group and go, well, the person that we want to take care of this issue is Ralph. Because everybody knows who Ralph is, and Ralph walks into the agency, and things might turn out
just a little bit different. So we're going to stop that from happening. If you are the owner of the company, we do not want to preclude you from doing that. So that's where we tried to reach some middle ground there. And if you're getting paid by the state of Alaska, which Representative Holmes pointed out, you can obviously go before the ombudsman or represent your constituents before the ombudsman, but you could not get paid by an outside individual to go before an ombudsman. So that is what tried to reach some middle ground there, which I'm going to get some disagreement by my friend to my right.
Thank you. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fixes some of the problems. A couple of problems still remain, and as you know, I have some other language that I have that takes up kind of where I'm going that we'll hopefully consider after this.
We certainly will consider it. It's the beauty
Thank
of the
you,
process.
Mr. Chairman, we
definitely,
will consider
definitely,
all
definitely, with an open mind.
Here are a couple of scenarios that I would see that would still be illegal under this scenario that I would suggest are not unethical. My good friend and colleague here, Representative Lynn, has a background as a realtor. I'm not picking on you, sir, don't worry. has a background as a realtor. If he were to go home during the interim and choose to engage in his given profession as a realtor, his profession is covered by a board of realtors, which is a state board. This would prohibit him in the exercise of his representation of his real estate clients in placing any telephone calls to the board of realtors. File any paperwork, even including mandatory disclosure style paperwork with the board of realtors. Have any interaction with them in any way, shape, or form, even when he's required to do so by law. My good friend to my left here, I can only assume I do not know the nature of his activities for his employer, but I have a guess it has something to do on occasion with Department of Transportation and the airports, that he has conversations with people at the airport, which is a branch of DOT, which is a state agency. I would suggest that it would preclude him from having any telephone calls, any written communication in any of any form with the Department of Transportation or any airport in the state, because they are an agency of the state. These are the kinds of things that would still be illegal under my reading of this.
Can you join us?
You may want to get Dave Jones up there too.
And Mr. Jones too. And okay, good examples, Representative Samuels. Do you arrive at the same conclusion?
I assume not.
No,
I don't. Under the person controlled by the legislature, the realtor who wanted to go before it would be obviously be in control of themselves.
Again, please.
The person who wanted to go before the board of realty would be in control of themselves, so that you could represent yourself. And as far as what I have done is, I do not contact DOT. I have chosen not to contact DOT. I was an administrator on a contract that my company held, and I recused myself from being the administrator of the contract. And I've done a number of other steps where I make sure that I have no interaction other than on the one case, and it was not a DOT issue, it was a tax dispute issue, and somebody needed to know how the business worked in general.
Representative Holmes?
Some of the things for Board of Realty, yes, he would be in his own capacity, but if there's any sort of issue that involves a client, Representative Lynn would not be able to do anything that involved that agency, that involved the client, and I would think that an airport as well, not just Department of Transportation as a whole.
Let me interrupt you for a moment. When you say for a client, you mean as a courtesy for that client in addition to the transaction that he was transacting, or do you mean germane to that transaction? Because if he's selling a house for somebody and then that client says, oh, by the way, would you mind writing a letter to the board of realtors? He couldn't do that. But he could continue to maintain the transaction and the sale of the house.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Are we talking about Board of Realtors, or are we talking about the Real Estate Commission?
Either or, I think.
Either or. Okay.
Either or. A board or a commission in this case. So I think Representative Samuels is saying that Representative Lynn could continue to transact the sale or the purchase of the piece of real estate. He just couldn't do any other courtesies for the client. And your interpretation is that he would not be able to contact the board or commission with regard to that transaction? Representative Dahlstrom?
Question. If there was a dispute when it comes down to selling time over whatever the issue is, and I've been in this position before, and the realtor and the agent and the purchaser and then the seller are all sitting there, would he be legally able to do that? Or anyone as a real estate agent if they were a legislator? That question.
If there
was a legal dispute over something that comes up right before closing or in the middle of closing, would the real estate agent who was a legislator be able to sit down at the table with a broker and the other broker and agent and person and discuss that, or would they have to recuse themselves from that?
I would say yes. Would you argue the point?
Would they have to? I'm sorry, one more time.
We're closing on a house. There's a transaction's almost done. There's some dispute that comes up. I'm not satisfied. I'm the one buying. I feel like I'm getting reamed. So I want to sit down with the broker and my agent, and then the seller and her broker agent. Can we sit down together and talk? Or under this language, would my agent, who's a legislator, be prohibited?
I would think he would be prohibited because he's doing it for you.
Very good. Mr. Jones?
I think the only instance in which that would be prohibited, Mr. Chairman, and through the chair of Representative Holmes, and would be if you were before a state agency.
Okay.
But if you were just sitting down with the other parties, that would not be prohibited.
I'm sorry, I was distracted. Would you repeat that, please, Mr. Johnson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My answer was that would be prohibited only if you were making that representation before an agency, board, or commission of the state, either legislative or executive branch.
Okay.
Not if you were just sitting across the table with the other parties.
Okay. Representative Holmes?
No, I believe that's correct if it's just you and the realtor, but if it's in any way, shape, or form connected with the board of realtors or the commission or anything like that, if it's an actual official proceeding or an arbitration that's governed by this board or commission, then it would be, I would think, covered by the statute.
Right. Joyce?
I agree with that.
Okay. The objection is maintained, I assume. Let's call the roll.
Representative Lind?
Pass.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative Grunberg?
No.
Representative Dahlstrom?
I'm going to pass.
Representative Coghill?
Yes.
Representative Samuels?
Yes.
Representative Ramros?
Yes.
Representative Lind?
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom?
Yes.
5 yes, 2 no.
Voting 036.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg.
Representative Holmes, so you could offer your amendment.
Yes, I'm going to offer my amendment if I may.
Just to get myself pulled together. Representative Samuels, do we need to look at this other one?
It took a slightly different tack. Mine is more restrictive than Amendment 27.
Okay. So we.
I don't know if you think it's either or. You pass this one. You can't pass this one. You just. We just changed the language in page 13, lines 12 through 25, and that's so this would just change it again.
Okay. All right. So we set it aside. Is what we just did. Do you wish to offer it?
Mr. Chairman, I think he's confused. I think he's talking about your other language set.
The other one had a title change, which was no longer necessary, so it is not.
We set it aside. That's correct.
Okay.
Okay, so All right, so I have The committee has before it amendment number 27, and I also show a conceptual amendment here, Jane. It says financial disclosures by legislative public members of committee and legislative directors.
Right, that's the last one in the packet. That's the first one in the packet.
Okay, so do I still have?
Yes, this would be the second one.
Okay.
That would be this.
Okay.
27.
Okay. We'll take just a brief of these. We are back on the we're back on the record. It is 3:22. Representative Lynn is in Labor and Commerce, where he has a bill up. The rest of the Judiciary Committee is still with us. We have whittled it down so that we have two remaining amendments before us. Amendment, let's bring back, I have a motion to bring back amendment number 27.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring back to the table amendment number 27.
And then Representative Holmes, you wanted to amend it. You wanted to substitute it for 27 amended, is that correct?
If I may, yes, please.
Okay, and so we have number 20, amendment number 27 amended before us. Is there an objection?
I'll object.
Okay, Coghill objects. So we have amendment number 27 amended before us for discussion. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that the language that we just passed in amendment 36, which has become our new section 16 of the bill, is still very overbroad. I think it would still preclude a lot of very routine activities by people when they are not here and in their course of their other business. I gave some of those examples earlier about realtors.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Joyce, Mr. Jones, do you concur with Representative Holmes's opinion that it precludes a lot of, is it fair to say, representational activity by the legislator? Is
no.
that the wrong characterization?
I believe it's not even representational, Mr. Chairman. I believe it's a lot of, I believe it precludes a lot of very routine communications with agencies, simply inquiring, asking questions, soliciting information, filing mandatory documents, any sort of interaction with agencies that may not be representational at all in the colloquial sense of the term.
Joyce, is that your impression, Mr. Jones? Is that your impression? And if the members will use amendment number 36 as a companion to section 16, that would be the correct way to now address this. It would be section 16 plus amendment number 36. And then we have before us amendment number 27 amended.
Mm-hmm.
And we are trying to ascertain whether that severely, if that's an appropriate word to use, restricts routine activity and routine communication by a legislator in conducting what would otherwise be seen as routine phone calls and communication with state agencies. Is that the rub? Is that,
that
fairly
is
well defined?
When in some sort of employment or being compensated.
Outside of your outside legislative of your activities.
Correct.
Representative Samuels?
Thank you. There's a question for Representative Holmes or for Mr. Jones, I guess. The way that I, without getting into the exact words, on Amendment 36, executive branch was banned, and on Amendment 27 amended, executive branch is reportable, and that is the crux of it.
Mr. Chairman, that is the main difference between the two. I would say that's a correct characterization.
And we should have the same debate with the way that we let me
ask as somebody who understands this less well. Less well. Isn't that an interesting phrase? I understand it less well than I wish I did. If amendment number 27 amended had the executive branch deleted, would it be very much like amendment number 36 then?
If you deleted executive branch from number 27 amended, would it be similar to 36?
Yes.
No, Mr. Chairman, it would not be.
Okay, all right. I just, for a second, I thought that was where we were going. That's what I wanted to.
If you'd like further brief explanation.
Sure.
Amendment 27 is a disclosure requirement for municipal, legislative, and executive branch agencies. Amendment number 36 is a disclosure requirement, I believe, for municipal and a prohibition on executive. Is that correct?
Yes. Unless you are representing yourself or a person controlled by you.
And just for a point of information, Mr.
President Coghill,
we're talking about taking compensation for representing before an administrative branch.
Yes.
Right. So number 27, you're an attorney. If you choose to do work during the remainder of the year in your field, this would not preclude you from doing that work, but you would have to disclose to the committee the name of the person represented, the subject matter of the representation, and the body before which the representation takes place. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But arguably, you would also have sway over those boards, commissions, or that body, because even once you fairly disclosed it to the APOC, you would still enjoy that intangible benefit when you went before those bodies, which gets to the rub of the concern. I'm not going to ask you if that's correct, because that's an unfair thing to. That's the rhetorical question, I guess I'm putting out there. Mr. Jones, you were about to say something.
Mr. Chair, you asked earlier about interpretation of the amendment. I think one of the difficulties with dealing with representation is the very broad definition of representation that exists in current statute. Under Alaska Statute 24.60.990, A15 defines representation to mean action taken on behalf of another, whether for compensation or not, including but not limited to telephone calls and meetings and appearances at proceedings or meetings. Now, the amendment doesn't use the term representation. It uses the term represent. But I would think that an interpreting court would look to representation as some indication of what represent means. So that's one of the challenges.
Hmm. Well, that was a cliffhanger.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Coghill.
So, if as a legislator or a legislative employee, whether it's the Fish Board or the Labor Relations Board or any other board, you could not do anything for compensation that would be somehow noticed before any one of those commissions. True?
Representative Coghill, through the chair. Under Amendment 36, that's true. Under Amendment 27, you would have to disclose it, but you could do it for compensation because it's an executive branch agency.
And Mr. Chairman, the reason I kind of leaned over towards 36 is because if we're looking for bright lines, prohibitions are brighter lines than disclosure. I must not. I can't say that I came to that position very easily, because you can't imagine all circumstances. But I think if we or legislative employees are drawing pay, and then to take pay for representing somebody else before one of these boards, whether it would be a Fish Board or Labor Relations Board or the Workers' Compensation Board or any other, I think that could be a real conflict of interest that becomes an ethical question. So I'm still listening, so I'm open to discussion.
Representative Samuels and then Grunberg.
I'll pass.
Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an amendment that, to borrow from Milton Friedman, is a trickle-down amendment. If you're the owner of the company and you're a legislator, you're protected. If you're an employee legislator, you're not. Let's say that I have a business, any kind of a business, and I employ another legislator, just so we have two legislators in the same business. The owner could go to pick up a dog license. The employee could not. The same with a garbage disposal permit. The same with a permit to burn firewood or anything like that. It only covers, protects the owner of the business. And that applies regardless of the kind of business. Other people who may represent, and I'm talking about the Section 16 as amended by Amendment 36. Accountants couldn't represent clients on any tax matters or even file the papers, even telephone to ask any questions about taxing issues. Engineers couldn't go and get variance permits, nor could people who do structural designing, surveyors, contractors. It's an amendment section that sweeps unduly broadly. Of course, attorneys are in the business of representing people, but so are others, and so virtually any employee might be asked to, in the words of the current amendment, as it's within the course and scope of their employment, go before an agency, even to renew a vehicle license plate at the DMV. That's representing the company, just to renew the company's vehicle license, or to go down and, let's say, register, take a note to the of a child to a school because they're absent because they're sick. That's going before an agency.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Are you finished?
Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to ask a question. Brooke, I'd like to ask you a question. It's fascinating to me how much subject matter we have covered in 36 amendments and with 27 notwithstanding yet. And in almost every day we had Representative Newman before us, the Newman Rule. And when we got all done down to it and we put up an amendment that we covered it, you could drive a truck right through it, and we defaulted to trying to broaden the business exemption and have it better mirror the medical and the legal profession exemption. And I find it now fascinating that we're trying to deal with the legal profession and we find ourselves in the exact same situation. We can agree on so much material that we've covered over these 5 days and the bill that was sent and shaped and then sent over from State Affairs. And here we're hung up on this the difference between, as Representative Coghill said, a prohibition, and as Representative Holmes is advocating, a disclosure, which is not very far away from the debate that we had with regard to Representative Newman making furniture and protecting his right to earn a livelihood in the other 8 months of the year. And so what I thought, and why I asked you to come up, Brooke, is would you go over briefly for me, because I don't know, what you touched on with regard to Representative Newman. You said, well, perhaps we can broaden it through the committee, the exemptions for business, and make it more closely mirror the exemptions that exist for the medical profession and for the legal profession. Can you give us just a very brief overview of what those exemptions presently are?
Well, I can. You mean for the legal profession and for...
For the medical.
For the medical profession. Basically, under the medical profession, anybody who under the HIPAA Act, now that that's very expansive, it covers almost all physicians. It could even cover someone giving massages. And that federal law prohibits those individuals from making their client names public. with respect to attorneys, it generally has to do with cases that involve children, any sealed cases, and other cases on a case-by-case basis that are brought to the commission under the exemption request.
Yes.
Is that helpful?
Sorry, say the last part again, please.
And with attorneys, it's the sealed cases, cases involving minor children, and basically any cases that are brought before the commission by the filer on a case-by-case basis.
Is there any way that we can expand through the committee to accommodate the wishes of Lindsay Holmes, Representative Holmes, or is it just too, as Representative Coghill said, is this too bright a line between prohibition and disclosure, which really sounds like what we're coming down to?
That's a difficult one for me to answer, but one of the questions that I would have in listening to the debate is that my understanding here, and Joyce could correct me, Mr. Chairman, if I'm wrong, is that we're talking about representation for compensation. So I don't, you know, most people do receive compensation for taking, you know, the sick note to school or getting your dog license or...
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cox.
And when I first went into this, I thought that, but the definition is where we're going to end up at. Now, it's explicit in the language that it's for compensation, but it's not, in fact, it's even more explicit in the definition that it, whether or not it's for compensation. So we're going to fly back into that tension. So unless we end up making it clear somewhere along the line, whether we change the definition of representation, because I think what we're trying to say is, you can't go make money on the public trust. That's what we're trying to say. And but here it says in representation, if you do it for free, if you're an advocate for somebody. So, and I'm an advocate for people all down. I have to disclose or get out of here. That means I have to disclose almost everything I do with purpose in my life. So I don't think it's meant to be taken to that level.
Which level?
To disclose everything you do that has any purpose in your life.
I think that's called prayer.
I'll disclose that.
Amen. Amen. Representative Samuels.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to follow up on Representative Grunberg's question. He's absolutely right. DMV question is the perfect question. Because if I'm going to register all the cars at my employer, and I'm just an employee guy, and I happen to be a legislator, and I call up Dwayne Bannock, go, hey, Dwayne, I don't really feel like standing in line. It's wrong. Do you think I'd get to the front of the line? Probably would. And that's the problem. If I go stand in line at DMV, I don't think I'm representing my employer. If I just stand in line, I pick a number, and I go up, and the gal there's not going to know who I am. Could I pull a string? Darn right I could.
Could you show up at the DMV without $20 to get your license?
So
a little more net.
The examples he gave, I think when the sick kid at school, I think you're getting probably a little far fetched with them. But the point is, you get treated differently,
Mr.
and that
Chairman.
Is a fact, and we all know it. I mean, we're the only ones that really know how we get treated, but we all know that we get treated differently.
Representative Coghill briefly, then Dahlstrom, then Grunberg.
Okay. Well, I agree that people see you differently, but what we're trying to do is say how we treat people, what we're allowed or what we're supposed to be doing. So we're not supposed to be taking money for things that you get paid as a legislator to do. Mm-hmm. To me, that's where I'm trying to figure out how to get to that line. I'm also saying that... that if you are going to take compensation for it, then you can't use your legislative or legislative employee status as the way to get it done. I don't know that you can ever get away from the influence issue. It's unethical in my view to flagrantly misuse that. But I can't. I do struggle with, just because you're a legislator doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to use that improperly. So that's why. I have probably flip-flopped in this debate a couple of times because I'm trying to figure out what we
should have adjourned.
Yeah. And I don't want to have a rules committee meeting on this one, necessarily.
Representative Kaka, I think it's wonderful that as we get down to the waning minutes
of this, we're debating ethics. I mean, that's really right at the root of what we're talking about today is the ethics of our position. And the very last subject matter that we're taking up is the ethical conduct of the legislator. Representative Dahlstrom, Gruenberg, and then Holmes, and then Samuels.
Mr. Chair, if these two's comments pertain to specific...
We'll come back to you. Representative Gruenberg.
I agree with Representative Coghill, and also to some extent with Representative Samuels. I think what should be prohibited is getting paid by a third person from doing legislative things. You know, like try and get a law changed or a regulation or a practice. You know, if I'm a lawyer and I represent somebody before, and they have a child support problem, and I call up the agency and they say, this is our policy on collecting child support. And I would say, well, gee, I think that you should change that policy, and I'm in the legislature. If you don't do it voluntarily, I'll do it legislatively. I mean, that's improper, and that's using, you know, getting compensated for doing something legislative. I think that the other thing is you shouldn't be able to use your influence in the same kind of a way. But that being said, the way I think to do that is to simply prohibit that kind of behavior. And it doesn't make any difference, really, whether you're doing it as part of your job, or you're doing it for yourself or your family, or you're doing it for your favorite charity. That's a different issue. The fact is that you're doing it, regardless for whom you're doing it. It's the activity, not whether you're doing it on the job or off the job. And this is the way the thing is drafted now, Mr. Chair. It's not only drafted too broadly, because it could prohibit the person who's going down to the DMV just to stand in line and pick up a license plate. But it's drafted too narrowly, because it doesn't prohibit that kind of behavior when you're doing it on your own behalf. It's both, in some senses, too broad, and in some senses, too narrow. And the only way you can do it in the Goldilocks sense, just right, is prohibiting the actual behavior, regardless of whether you do it on the job, regardless of whether you do it for yourself or somebody else, regardless of whether you do it for compensation. Just prohibit the act.
Representative Holmes, and then Samuel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to support what Representatives Coghill and Gruenberg are saying. This is an ethics statute, and in prohibiting certain behavior, we are saying that any violation of that or any action that's prohibited under the statute is by definition unethical. And I am very afraid that we're picking up, in the sense of being too broad, we're picking up routine actions done by people in the course of their employment. And keep in mind, please, that this does not just apply to legislators. This entire section applies to all legislative employees, people who have a lot less influence than us. It would preclude them in an employment situation or working for compensation in any sense from doing very routine things that are not, I think, in anybody's or most people's estimation, unethical. Picking up the phone to make a simple inquiry, not asking for any action, just simply asking to clarify a rule, asking, how do I do this? Where do I go? Very, very routine, everyday activities where you're not making any attempt to have any influence, and you probably aren't having any influence because it's happening just as if somebody else picked up the phone. And you have people working in large corporations where you may have a number of employees who could do it, and the best choice for the legislator would to say, you know, that might be something where there might be influence, or I might get that done faster if I did it. It's not, why don't you ask the person down the hall to do this? But you might be in the context of a small business where there may only be one or two employees. There may not be somebody down the hall, and it may be a routine action. And this would make that, by definition, unethical. And that's a pretty strong accusation. Any individual legislator or legislative employee lives in fear of having an ethics violation brought against them. And to have out there the danger that I or one of my staffers or one of any of your staffers or anybody who works in this building could be hauled in front of the ethics committee for picking up the phone and calling and saying, where's the local office? Is pretty harsh.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you. We just had a debate here a little while ago and unanimously passed an amendment, which we all think might be unconstitutional, to stop spouses, our spouses, from lobbying solely because of the appearance. Never been an accusation, as far as I know, on a spouse. The activities Representative Gruenberg alluded to, they're already illegal. If I go out and sell my services, that's a bribe. That's illegal. So we outlawed the spouses from doing it because of the appearance. And if you want to get rid of the appearance, you draw the line. And the line is drawn right there. And I understand that you draw the line over here where you can't go to the DMV, that's fine. But what about the Board of Fish? Because I had to choose an attorney or a representative, and I were a seafood company or a fishing company or or anything that wanted anything from the Board of Fish, I have a leg up if I hire a legislator. Because you walk in the room, and they all sit around, and they know that you're going to vote on bills. You can drop bills in. You control the fish and game budget. You have all of this things that you can do. And the appearance is that it's you've got a leg up. Your opponents are going to think it. If they lose the case, and nobody voted any differently at all on the Board of Fish, it's a 4-3 vote on the Board of Fish, and the side that I represented as a representative for a entity that had an issue before the Board of Fish wins, the trust of the people in their government falls. The same as the spouse. It's the perception that we're trying to get to. And the perception is going to be that if you're a legislator, you throw your weight around and you got your way, whether you did or you did not. You go and get a permit, you do all of these things, people know this is Lindsay Holmes, this is Ralph Samuels, and people know who you are, whether it is a change or a not change in how the outcome of the event, the perception will be there, and the entire point of the entire bill isn't to outlaw bribery. Bribery is already illegal. The point of the bill is to get people to have confidence in their government. So you get rid of the perception, you draw the line. And I understand the downsides. I get it. But the upsides are you're trying to restore some confidence whatsoever in government. And it's a lifelong goal. After this, there's going to be another 10 years go by, and we're going to go through this whole thing again. We're going to plug other little holes. And then 10 years after that, people are going to plug little holes. And it's an ongoing experience. But for right now, if you don't draw the line, then nobody is doing anything wrong, but the perception is that there's advantage being taken.
I'd like to offer three observations. One is sometime in the first quarter, I go visit the Seattle where my customers are, the ones that I disclose, three of the largest ones that I disclose to APOC, Cruz West, Royal Celebrity, and Princess. I know how I was treated before I was in the legislature, and I know how I'm treated by them since I was in the legislature, and it is a noticeable difference. I have occasion to go to the Alaska court system. I've gone there for victim's testimony because of property crime, which is why I sought the chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee, is because
I have been the victim of a lot of property crime, and I see a lot of alcohol and substance abuse. I know how I was treated in the Alaska court system, from the security people downstairs to the attorneys to the judges to the trooper people that have the guns in the courtrooms. I know how I was treated before I was in the legislature, and I know how I was treated now. And the third observation that I would make that would go to the concern that you have about earning a livelihood is, I can tell you for a fact that I lose money in my private sector position 8 months of the year. And the only 4 months of the year that I make money are from May 15th till September 15th. And I have to earn about 140% of my income because I lose the other 40% back the ensuing 8 months. It is not just a diminishment of my quality of life to be here for special sessions. It has the potential of wrecking me financially. But it is the voluntary choice that I make for the privilege of holding public office, for leaving the private sector to represent my constituents. I can get a little bit of good things done, and I can stop a lot of bad things from happening. And I really enjoy that opportunity and that duty and that privilege to serve. And the fact that it costs me money, the fact that I have exposure every spring to not being able to return to my livelihood during the only 120 days when I can earn it, is the price that I pay for the privilege of being a representative of the state of Alaska and the 1/40th of those people that I serve humbly most of the time. And I'm going to get more serious, Representative Cockhill. I swear, I'm really going to grow up. I'm going to start right after this bill is over. This is like my last smoke, I swear.
You'll be an old man when this bill is over.
I see from those three examples, my experience in the Alaska court system, my experience in Seattle visiting my principal customer base, and my exposure every spring to whether we're going to be here or not, and my guess is we will be here come May 15th, 16th, 17th. And that's the way it goes. And if I don't like the job, then we just passed an amendment where I can do my 90-day exit interview with the state and move back into the private sector full-time. And so if I have to make a choice on this issue between disclosure and prohibition, I am going to side with the people of Alaska as I see it, for those that I represent, and I am going to side with prohibition because it's a clearer, brighter line, and I'm more comfortable with it, even if that deprives some of my friends and my colleagues, who I respect very much, of some of their rights. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're right. We all do get treated differently. And we all do make a lot of sacrifices to be down here. I know all 60 of us make a lot of sacrifices, and most of us have to maintain two households and move back and forth. Massive disruption for those of us who are able to work, for those of us who can find a way, find somebody who will employ us or some way to own our own business. It's not easy on an employer to have an employee who's gone a guaranteed 120 or in the future guaranteed 90 days, and quite possibly at unanticipated periods throughout the year, called away if we end up doing more committee meeting in the interim, very disruptive on an employer. So I would suggest that everybody is in that situation. And we all do get treated differently. And I cannot side with erring on the side of not allowing employees to do routine activities in front of the state, but allowing somebody who has the fortune to own their own business to conduct that sort of action, to go in front of a board or agency on behalf of their own business, to take advantage, whether intentionally or, I understand, largely unintentionally, but get the advantage of having that legislator title after you, whereas you say nobody else, while massively restricting the ability of anybody else to appear or even pick up the phone and make a telephone call to an agency. I think this is very restrictive language that we have on Section 36, and it applies to legislators and legislative employees. And I think we will see if it is actually implemented as required by law and people are actually complying with it, I think it's going to be really, really broad. I think it's going to be a really big prohibition and make it really hard for a lot of people around here to make a living when they're not here.
Representative Grunberg.
With all due respect, Mr. Chairman, the way Section 36 is drafted now, you're one of the people on the committee who could do what they do because you have your own business. People who work for other people and are legislators couldn't. So you're one of the protected people. The way the thing is drafted now protects you, but it doesn't protect some of the rest of us. Is that what you want?
If that's a direct question for me, the answer is I'm interested in my own welfare as much as I'm interested in your welfare and the welfare of Representative Newman and those other elected officials. I struggle with this also, but at some point or another, we have to default to what is in the best interest of the people. Certainly, me being down here and having the risk of being down here past May 15th is not in my best interest. I have a unique business that that doesn't enjoy equal exposure throughout the 12 months of the year. And one could argue that somebody in the legal profession enjoys advantages that I don't have because of the seasonality of my work and the manner in which it conflicts with the time that we're in the that we have exposure to special sessions, which are most highly likely as they would abut right up to the regular sessions. So I think I could just as easily cry hardship for when the special sessions take place. So I appreciate the criticism, but I don't see myself in a protected class, if you will. I see myself representative of those of us that are elected that get treated differently where we go, and it's not fair that I get treated differently in a conference room at the headquarters of Princess Cruises, but it's entirely different to not be treated fairly in front of a board or commission or at the Alaska court system or in an adjudicatory a body that does some degree of adjudication. And for me, that's the brighter line that I come down on. There are degrees of fairness, and I think that we stumbled into that with Representative Newman relative to the medical profession or the legal profession as it currently exists. This isn't about fairness. This is about ethics. And when it comes to ethics, it's low common denominator ethics as it applies to the broadest possible number. Representative Holmes and then Samuels.
Then I would suggest that if all of this other behavior we're discussing is unethical, that an owner of a business should never appear in front of any of these groups or do any of these activities on their own. They should have to have an employee or somebody down the hall do it for them. If this is our concern, is legislators being treated differently, I don't see why an owner of a business should be able to go apply for the permit or make the call or meet with the people if an employee can't.
Representative Samuel?
Thank you. And I would disagree. An owner of a business is representing themselves. By definition, you are representing yourself. If I'm going before a DMV to represent myself as an individual, that's one thing. Or it's me, and if you have to be the majority in person controlled by, then you're representing yourself. President Dahlstrom has a business, you're representing yourself. You're not representing another person. And I think there's a vast difference there between being paid to sway somebody's opinion when you're going in to speak on your own behalf.
Representative Samuels, I'm a member of CHAR, Cabaret and Hotel Restaurant. Our business is a member of CHAR. I have a significant peer group that are licensees. I have had occasion many times in the regular conduct of my business to call on behalf of myself as a licensee because I always separate and tell them whether I'm calling professionally or whether I'm calling as a licensee. Senator Terrio taught me about the use of the words always and never. So I'm now careful when I use the words always and never. But I will tell you that I have never called on behalf of another licensee because as an elected official, that is a bright line.
never called on behalf of another licensee. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want the members of this committee to know, and I want it to reflect in the record that I think, like everybody on this committee, I mean, this is kind of coming to a head right now, and I have been searching my head, my heart, my gut, everything for the right answer on this. And my preference, in my perfect world, would be to totally withdraw Section 16. But because I do not have an answer or a suggestion that will fix the loopholes that would leave, I'm not going to do that. But I just would like the record to reflect that.
So noted. Representative Grunberg?
I might refer Representative Dahlstrom and the rest to Section 15, which already says that a legislator may not directly or authorize another to accept compensation for work associated with legislative action, administrative action, or political action, as defined in the law.
I think we're all comfortable with Section 15.
Yeah.
I
consider that an amendment, I think.
I'm just fascinated. I have prohibition to my left, and I have disclosure to my right, and it's fascinating. It's a fascinating discussion, and the subject at hand is ethics, and I find it fascinating that we went through all the amendments and came down to the most contentious amendment last, and here it is, and it strikes me that that's why Governor Palin is on the third floor now, is because this is one of the issues that she brought before the public. Prohibition versus disclosure. And it's a fascinating subject matter. In this case, speaking for myself, and I'm happy to give this ample time for debate in the committee. Speaking for myself, given a choice, I'm going to opt for the prohibition standard that we adopted, because it's a lower common denominator, and I like low common denominators. Disclosure leaves gaps. I like bright lines. With that, the objection I'm certain is maintained. Susan, would you take the roll, please?
Representative Holmes.
I'm sorry, Susan, this is for amendment number 27 amended by Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, can we make a quick change to this on line 15? Towards the end of line 15, we need to delete the word take. That was a typo.
Okay.
Representative Samuel.
Okay. The amendment to the amendment is made. There's no objection. Number 27, as amended, is before us. Susan, will you please take the roll?
Representative Holmes.
Yes.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom.
No.
Representative Coghill.
No.
Representative Samuels.
No.
Representative Lynn.
No.
Representative Rammers.
No.
2 yes, 5 no.
All right, so by a vote of 5-2, number 27 amended fails. I believe that this is all the... We have one more amendment before the committee. Is this this one right here? I'm sorry. Right, Representative Holmes. I apologize. We have before us a conceptual amendment by Representative Holmes, and this is amendment number 37 or 38. 37?
Do we have this all read?
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, this is page 19, lines 18 through 26.
Yes, Susan, that's right.
I'll move amendment 37.
Amendment number 37 has been moved. I hear an objection.
I'll object, Mr.
Chairman.
Representative Coghill objects. Representative Holmes, you speak to number 37.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. During the course of our very, very long week that we have had here in House Judiciary, there's been some discussion about trying to conform, make things kind of simple and conform what we're doing in the legislative and the executive branch and kind of keep them in parallel. And what this amendment would do is take Section 26, which applies to the legislative branch, and conform it with what is required of the executive branch, which is in Section 31, in terms of disclosures of income for personal services. And I believe it also, just double checking, I believe it also wraps in, there's been talk of, over the course of the last year or so, of the need to be clear on the record that we also mean deferred compensation, and the reference, that's where the reference on line 6 is for deferred compensation, and the limited liability company is simply in there because I believe existing statutes and regs only referred to, you know, limited liability companies are fairly new entities that were not covered by prior statutes and regs, so that's the reason for adding that in.
Is there a discussion?
I need to read it.
Representative Samuels, you're reading it?
I need to.
Joyce, can you give us an ethics opinion on this, please?
Actually, I'm going to defer to Brooke Miles. She is, even though it's in our statute, she administers that section. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
It appears to do exactly as Representative Holmes said, and make the requirements for the legislative financial disclosure exactly the same words and as for executive. Is that, are you helping me out here, Dave? But that, I mean, actually, when that happens, when they're the same, it makes it easier for the commission. It makes it easier for us to explain the rules to a legislator and to a public official who files financial disclosure, because they have the same rules and actually even the same words requiring that disclosure.
Good. Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. Miles.
Oh, as amended, right. Okay.
So basically, the form is going to ask us the question, and then just instead of blank lines there's going to be a number one or A, name and address, B, and it's going to ask those specific questions so there's no doubt and every line needs to be filled out.
We will make our very best effort to make the form as simple and easy to follow as possible so that all of the it's clear what information is required where.
So if you were on the board of an energy company and you took a $35,000 payment as deferred income, and you would then list that you had served as a board member and went to quarterly or monthly meetings, and that this was that you were paid the same as other board members, for instance, but you opted to take it as deferred income?
That's correct. It would be noted as deferred income, but still disclosed to the public as income.
Okay. Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, just a technical, in our haste to get this out into your committee as quickly as possible, there are two typos that I'd like to ask for an amendment on that.
Sure.
In line 10, the words of the appear twice. If we could delete one of the of these.
Oh.
And then in the final line 16, the word 8 should actually be date.
All right. And Susan, this is a conceptual amendment, so the drafters will correct this. Representative Samuels?
I just want to make sure from the sponsor, you're adding the deferred compensation, but generally that's the amendment. I mean, adding the deferred compensation and the LLC.
I am adding the deferred compensation and the LLC, and then I am making what is actually disclosed conform basically exactly. The only exception is... in the executive, it makes you disclose who the recipient of the income or the gift is, because executives have to disclose other family members. But since that's not the case here, I deleted that line. But everything else should be, I believe, Ms. Miles, word for word the same as Section 31, which applies to executives.
I believe that's true. However, the legislative financial disclosures are also responsible for filing the disclosure statement on behalf of themselves, their domestic partner, spouse, and dependent children.
And I am happy if you guys want, we could add that line in. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That was an oversight on my part to leave out. That would make it, with that change, if we could add in a new Part B and move everything else down that says the recipient of the income or gift, that would make it word for word the same as the Section 31.
All right, so let's have you offer an amendment to the amendment, and would you state that for Susan, please?
Yes, please. I would like to add a new subsection in between what are now subsections A and B on lines 9 and 10, which would be labeled subsection B, which would say the recipient of the income or gift, semicolon. And then the existing lines B through E would all move down. B would become C, C would become D, et cetera.
Just renumber
them accordingly.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
The word gift actually is not appropriate in this part of the statute because this is your APOC disclosure, and legislators, legislative employees report their gifts under a separate section to the Legislative Ethics Committee. Okay. So without the word gift.
Of the income?
Yes, thank you.
That, and that's what threw me off in the drafting, okay, as I was looking at gifts.
Susan, do you have that amendment? So without objection, that amendment has been accepted, Representative Cockhill?
The gift?
No, of course not. No, the gift has been excluded.
I was going to say.
Yeah. So it doesn't belong in
the other one is the
recipient of the income.
Yes.
Was the amendment to the amendment.
No objection.
Okay. Representative Dahlstrom and then Lynn.
I didn't have any comments.
No, I'm fine.
I may, though.
Are there any, Representative Samuels?
Thank you. Thank you.
We're back to the conceptual amendment number 37.
A question, I guess, for Mr. Jones. Is deferred compensation, and I know what it is, does it need any further definition? I mean, somebody's...
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, I think that's a term of well enough general understanding that'll work.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Are there other questions regarding amendment number 37? Is the objection maintained?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cockhill?
The language in sub E is, isn't it somewhat new language to what we had previously? And I'm just asking the maker of the amendment a description sufficient to make clear to a person of ordinary understanding the nature of each service. I don't think that that's the same language that we put in the language for the executive. Is it really?
Okay.
I thought we had amended that. That's all.
If I may.
Oh, without question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cockhill.
Member of the committee.
Please.
Representative Cockhill, at different points, we considered amendments that included that language and rejected them in favor of others. But the current language for the executive includes similar language.
You can see I've been overdosed on amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Is the objection maintained?
No, sir.
If the objection is lifted, without objection, amendment number 37 passes. We have before us House Bill 109, Judiciary. Before we move the bill, are there any, or entertain a motion to move the bill, are there any remaining issues, questions, discussion amongst the members? Are we talked out? Representative Lynn?
Well, I don't have anything. I'd just like to state that I think I'm very proud to be a legislator and to have been in state affairs and this committee working on this bill. I think this governor's ethics bill is truly landmark legislation, which sets a much stronger foundation than we had previously. We used to say in the military, we'd done good. And I think this is a very good piece of legislation, and I think we can all be proud. It's not perfect legislation because we're not perfect legislators, but we've done good.
Any other remarks?
Thanks to Jane.
Yes. Yeah. Jane Pearson, kudos to you. What a splendid job you did.
You're doing a memory for that.
Comes back before you guys.
There is one other thing I'd like to
Representative Samuels
bring up, Mr. Chairman. The branch of government we did not talk about. the judiciaries ethics. And just for the information of the committee and who might be watching, on our ethics committee, we have four legislators. We have five citizens. The chairman must be a citizen. In the judicial branch, they have six attorneys and three citizens. Three attorneys who do business before the bar, three judges whom are colleagues with the person who has a complaint against them, and three citizens. And the question that I asked in the budget subcommittee on the Commission on Judicial Conduct was that if we had a legislative ethics committee with six legislators and three citizens, how do you think the public would see that? And I did not offer an amendment, although I did have one drafted, to change that, to put the citizens in charge of complaints on the judiciary rather than the judiciary in charge of complaints on the judiciary, because it strikes me as wrong, and there may be a bill in the making there just to do just that. Thank you.
You may have a co-sponsor.
I would entertain.
You'll also have lively debate,
Mr.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would make the motion that we move the CS for House Bill number 10925-GH1059 /0 with the conceptual and written amendments as approved with individual recommendations.
Representative Grunberg?
Do we have to have new fiscal notes?
You shouldn't think so.
No.
Are they zero fiscal notes?
Your motion includes the attached fiscal notes.
And any attached fiscal notes.
And this goes on to the Rules Committee next, is that correct? Do you object?
No.
Okay. Without objection, House Bill 109 passes from Judiciary on its way to the Rules Chairman. Again, Tammy, my thanks to you for your help, Brooke Miles and Joyce Anderson and Dave Jones, and then I'd also the other forgotten person who's done yeoman's work on this is our friend Susan Ryle, who has maintained 37 amendments and counting, a lot of unruly personalities. So our collective apology for behavior. Thank the committee. It is 4:20, and we are adjourned.